In this video, I will explain the 10 core ideas of Thomas Carlyle. Now, Carlyle wrote quite a lot of stuff. These are all of his books here, and the shelf keeps on going on all the way down there. And then I've got other Carlyle books over on the shelf that you can't see here. I have written about Carlyle in this book, The Prophets of Doom. There he is there. And he is quite a difficult writer, because of his rhetorical style, and because of the fact that, unlike many other writers, he did not write one core treatise. So his ideas are scattered among articles and essays and various different books here and there. And because of his personality, he wasn't one to kind of sit down and write a thesis in that way. So you have to kind of pick out his ideas over his entire corpus. In this video, I'm going to do exactly that for you. So let me get up my presentation here, if I can. And I'll put myself down in this little box. Let us begin. So I would say that his most famous idea is that great men make history. For Carlyle, history is not the product of impersonal economic forces, class struggle, or collective will. It is, above all, the work of exceptional individuals, heroes whose vision, energy, and force of character bend the arc of events. The masses do not make history. They follow it. Once a great man has shown the way. And if anybody's heard of Carlyle, like if he's a vote devil, it's probably for this idea. Which, you know, when I was in school was routinely mocked, because there's nothing that the liberal order dislikes more than this idea. It loves the idea of what I call the Forrest Gump theory of history, that we are all just kind of particles floating in the winds, and, you know, the arc of history will inevitably move in a certain current. That's something like the liberal version of history. Whereas in this version of history, you get these phenomenal individuals. And, you know, great men can take many forms, according to Carlyle. For Carlyle, Shakespeare was a great man of history, even though he was just a writer. You know, you might think of prophets, you know, like Muhammad or Moses. These are, or Jesus, of course, or Buddha. Or a great man can be a king, a political leader, you know, somebody like Napoleon, for example, or Genghis Khan. And one of the things that Carlyle talks about is that it is not simply that these men are just kind of, you know, they are just kind of built different, although that is part of it, that they tap into something in what you might call the zeitgeist or the spirit of the moment. They grasp the moment by the metal. They sense something that's in the air, and they bring it into themselves, and then they push it outwards. Okay, and so it's almost kind of like these figures are almost magic conduits of something that's happening. Okay. He also argues that hero worship is natural and necessary. Carlyle argued that the instinct to admire and follow genuine greatness is not weakness. It is one of humanity's healthiest impulses. Societies thrive when they recognize and subordinate themselves to leaders of real vision and character. So this is, again, something that liberals, I would say in general, balk at. That we are not encouraged in some ways to think along these lines. But then if you think about it, does the liberal order destroy hero worship, or does it actually feed into it in other mediated ways? I mean, down here on my shelf, I've got books on David Bowie. His album, Ziggy Stardust, if you remember, was all about how the rock star becomes almost the hero of our age. Okay, think of Elvis Presley, think of Michael Jackson. And, you know, there's not a million miles to from Michael Jackson up there to, I don't know, a dictator, for example, or a man of the people, or you know, some other great leader or prophet. So even though liberal culture despises this idea, it also cannot help but give it purchase. It cannot help but come back again. Now we live in the age of social media, where people gain followers to themselves. Oh, this person's got this so many million followers, and this person's got that so many million followers. So it's there's obviously some impetus that Carlyle is picking up on in human nature that needs this. And what Carlyle is saying is that this isn't, you know, this is actually natural and normal. So the best thing we can do is hope for the best great men. We actually want people of genuine character, people of genuine wisdom, people who are actually going to guide us in the right way. And you could argue that the problem with the modern age is that it's full of false prophets. It's full of bad guidance. It's full of bad heroes. Again, I refer you back to the pop stars and the rock stars and so on, with their promotion of, you know, degenerate lifestyles and so on and so forth. And you can see that Carlyle would say, well, look, these are occupying the space of great men or great women, but they are not actually fulfilling the role. They are sham captains, as Carlyle would call them. He argues that the modern age suffers from hero-lessness. Okay? Now, I've just said that people occupy those spaces, but do they live up to what the hero should be? Do they give good guidance to people? Sadly, they're often found wanting. Democracy and industrialism, Carlyle warned, had conspired to produce a civilization that could no longer recognize, much less produce, genuine leaders. What remained was the cash nexus, all human bonds reduced to monetary transaction, and mediocrity elevated by ballot and marketplace alike. So this is getting on to some of Carlyle's favorite hobby horses. He didn't like democracy because of its tendency to promote charlatans. And I mean, you can pick your favorite politicians, which one of them is not a liar. And he didn't like the marketplace because of its reduction of human relations to what he called the cash nexus of man to man, the reduction of social relations to financial relations. Carlyle saw this as eating away at the fabric of society. For Carlyle, who came from a Calvinist background, even though he was not a Calvinist himself, his theology is often described as Calvinism without Calvin. You know, he was Scottish. He argues that work and duty are sacred. The gospel of work says that honest labor is not merely an economic activity. It is a moral and even spiritual one. Through work, a person finds their place in the world and fulfills their duty to something larger than themselves. He said, a healthy society is one in which individuals feel called to their tasks. And you can see this Calvinistic idea of the calling. The call, what are you here for? Why has God put you here? And if you don't find your vocation, if you don't find that, then you can fall into idleness. You can fall into aimlessness. And for him, for Carlyle, these are forms of spiritual corruption, as dangerous as any external threat. He argues for duty over comfort. He held a deep contempt for the pursuit of happiness as a social goal. You know, that phrase, the pursuit of happiness, is right there in the American Constitution, one of the foundation stones of modern democracy. He argued that you need purpose, you need discipline, earnest effort, not pleasure, as marks of a life well lived. He was trying to get back to something closer to the Aristotelian concept of fulfillment and a job well done, than simply happy. What does that mean, happy? You know, and again, this relates back to a lot of his hobby horses. He was always talking about mammon worship, the worship of money, and then the things that you pay, you know, you pay money to try to make yourself happy, but what are you buying? Oftentimes it's, you know, hedonistic pursuits and a sugar rush, really, that doesn't truly make you happy, doesn't truly make you fulfilled. All of these things are in Carlyle. He saw industrial society as dehumanizing. The factory system and laissez-faire economics, Carlyle argued, had reduced human beings to interchangeable units of production. The worker was no longer a person with dignity and a soul. He was a hand, bought and discarded by the market. And this was when Carlyle coined the phrase, the condition of England question. He insisted that this condition of England question was not merely an economic problem, but a moral catastrophe. It was evidence of a society that had forgotten what human beings are for. Now, this may be ringing echoes for some people of Karl Marx, of Marxism. And Marx and Engels were fans of Carlyle. They read Carlyle. And so in a strange way, even though Carlyle was demonstrably a kind of rightist, reactionary sort of thinker, he was also quite influential on Marx and Engels in their formative years. And you can see how some of his ideas play into Marxist notions of alienation theory and various other things. Although I would argue that the strong moral and spiritual component was eventually stripped out by Marx. If you're enjoying this video, I will remind you, I do teach courses here at the Academic Agency. Trivium is the bestseller. Many other great courses, Foundations of Shakespeare, you may enjoy. If you're interested in Carlyle, I did write this book, as I mentioned at the start, Prophets of Doom, which has got a whole chapter going into greater depth. But let's get back to the lecture at hand. Democracy is often rule by the worst, according to Carlyle. The problem with universal suffrage, says Carlyle, is that it is numbers, okay, and the mass, you know, the greater show of hands, the show of heads, as Carlyle talks about it, do not produce wisdom. And this, in this, Carlyle was diametrically opposed to Edmund Burke. Edmund Burke said, individually, individually, the peasant is foolish, but en masse, he is wise. Carlyle's like, absolute nonsense, Burke. The majority tends to vote to elevate the loudest, the most plausible, the most unscrupulous, not the most capable. And again, I will point you to every single Democratic politician you can think of. To a man, a charlatan, to a man, a quack, to a man, a sham captain, to a man makes promises that he cannot keep, possibly corrupt. And Carlyle is arguing that this is not an accident. This is what happens when you select your leaders by show of heads. People are just easily tricked. And so it promotes the charlatan. Also, you need money to get ahead in a democracy. So it promotes unscrupulous people, easily bought people as well. And if you doubt this analysis, take a look at around Congress, etc. There's also the swarmery, another great Carlyleism. He saw parliamentary government as a theater of eloquence and interest, where genuine authority was dissolved into rhetoric and deal-making and kind of busy work. He's very scathing about normal politics, parliamentary politics. This spectacle is then mistaken for governance. And again, you know, just watch PMQs. Next time Keir Starmer or whoever the Prime Minister is does PMQs, just watch the spectacle of it. that is the swarmery that Carlyle was so contemptuous of. Finally, he says that this is a dangerous illusion. To Carlyle, the belief that voting could substitute for leadership was one of the defining delusions of the modern age, comfortable, popular, and deeply destructive. And again, now you may have democratic priors watching this video, you may be a liberal, but I ask you, look at the decision-making done, look at the leaders who've been, look at the presidents of the USA, let's say since World War II, or the prime ministers of Britain, let's say since World War II, and ask yourself how much wise governance was done by those presidents or those prime ministers. Can you honestly say that the people decided for the best of the country? Carlyle was making these points back in Queen Victoria's time. For Carlyle, history is the biography of great men. His most famous claim is that to understand any age is to study its commanding figures. One of his heroes was Oliver Cromwell. He wrote a massive biography of Frederick the Great, that's Frederick II of Prussia, and the French Revolution. This is his book, The French Revolution. He argues these things are not simply social history. They are portraits of will, character, and fate. The individual, not the system, is where history lives. And he's not denying that there is such a thing as a mass. He's not denying that the normal people exist. He's not denying even that you can have something like the spirit of the age. What he's saying is an actual deeper point, that to understand the spirit of an age, you have to look at its exceptional individuals. And this, again, is a very different orientation to certain Marxists, those of the Annales school, for example, who want to look at normal men and women. He's like, well, if you truly want to, if you want to understand the Victorian age, who was there? Right, it's the, well, in that age, the closest thing to the great men were the tycoons. It was the industrialists. Or if you want to understand the Elizabethan age, you're looking at, Sir Walter Raleigh and people like this, who was an adventurer, right? So we're getting to, you can get closer to the spirit of the age by looking at these famous people, is what he's saying. Silence and sincerity are virtues. So Carlyle reserved his sharpest contempt for hollow rhetoric, public language that performs virtue without embodying it. Now, these days, people are used to talking about virtue signaling, but arguably Thomas Carlyle got to that concept all the way back in the Victorian era, and he launches scathing attacks on, liberal ninnies. Kind of little do-gooders who think, who basically want to present to the world that they are virtuous. And he reserves special vehemence for these sorts of characters because often it's empty. Often they are just, virtue signaling. The value of silence. Speech is only meaningful when it emerges from genuine thought and feeling. A society addicted to words has lost contact with reality, according to Carlyle. And finally, the true leader and the true thinker is one who means what he says and whose inner life matches his outward expression. So one of the things that Carlyle is obsessed with is people being truthful, with people not being charlatans, with people being true to their word, with people... And he saw the society around the London that he lived in as being one fundamentally filled with deceit, with mendacity, with tricksters and swindlers around every corner. And, I've never been in Victorian London, but if we are to believe the depictions from Charles Dickens, another famous fan of Carlyle, he carried a copy of the French Revolution wherever he went with him, strongly influenced by Carlyle. but in Charles Dickens's novels, you can see the extent to which mendacity and deceit were running through the society of that era, despite what, you know, some people now may want to cast back on it and romanticize the era. Actually, it had a lot of its own problems, which Carlyle was an acute critic of. So what does he argue for? Ultimately, a new aristocracy of talent is required, of talent. Carlyle rejected both the old aristocracy of birth, which he thought had vacated its due. He basically saw those as absentee landlords. They'd given up their position. They'd allowed the industrialist in. They were asleep at the wheel, so they deserved to be swept aside. So Carlyle was very unsentimental in the way he dealt with old ruling classes. Another big difference between Edmund Burke and Carlyle. You know, he argues in the French Revolution, for example, that the old French aristocracy had had its time. It had become corrupt. It had become morally compromised and therefore deserved to be purged with fire. So why would you want to save it? So he had no sentimentality whatsoever for this. He wasn't a traditionalist in that sense. He was very traditional in the way that he thought, but not for particular orders, particular families, particular bloodlines. Secondly, he didn't want the new plutocracy of wealth. Okay, now he did make some arguments for the industrial tycoons to embrace a role as captains of industry. But ideally, like, that was a kind of second best solution for Carlyle. What he really wanted was a genuine elite, one grounded in ability, in character, and a sense of duty to those beneath them. So that idea of the captains of industry is like, well, look, if you truly are this new aristocracy, if you are the best among us, don't just be a sausage maker on the great scale, Bobus Higgins. How about actually leading? How about taking wise decisions for everybody else? How about actually embodying being like your best sense and having a duty, a noblesse oblige to those who are working for you? And in this way, maybe they could become something like this new aristocracy of talent. The aristocracy of talent would lead not by right of inheritance or accident of fortune, but by demonstrable fitness to lead, a standard as demanding as it is undemocratic. And that was really his ideal. And he looked back to the 12th century and to other times in history where it was closer to what his ideal would be of this type of aristocracy. And finally, Carlyle's legacy. I say it's a difficult inheritance because he is a difficult writer. His style is deliberately archaic, even at the time that he was writing. So he can be a struggle when you first contact, when you first kind of come into contact with him. But like I said, he's inspired thinkers on the left and on the right. Many of his critiques have endured. The reason he was called the Sage of Chelsea is because he made lots and lots of predictions that ended up coming true 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, and some of them with stunning specificity. He's got one essay on Haiti, for example, when there was the slave revolt, and he said, listen, in 200 years' time, this place is going to, you know, the 200-year history of that place is going to be bloody. It's going to be one of abject poverty. It's going to be awful. That basically happened. Many of the things that he predicted for Britain came into being. That is why he was called the Sage of Chelsea. So, he is definitely somebody, whether you're from the right or the left, that you need to read. He's a very important thinker. I would argue somewhat downplayed since World War II for various different reasons, but now is being rediscovered and re-embraced. and his former position as being quite central to the English canon is now coming into being once more. If you want to read my chapter, it's in Prophets of Doom. I encourage you to pick up a course at the academic agency. Trivium is the bestseller. Most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, get out. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.